Today, I come to you not as a man, but as a robot. You may notice something slightly off in my voice. The reason is that I never said any of this. I typed it. You are hearing a robot speaking as me. In this episode, we want to talk about a personal hero of ours, Anthony Bourdain. What is the relevance of me introducing this show as a robot? Stay tuned to find out. I wish robots had more emotion. This intro feels like it needs a dot 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 bit dot 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 more dot 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 P-I-Z-Z-A-Z dot. Like I'm on my tiptoes, baby, you think a little too small. I got big goals, baby, hey, where the money? Yeah, look, I just need the info, pronto. I go and get it, split it with my kinfolk.
It's time for another serving of Unchef, a critical and often humorous look at the politics and history of food and agriculture from the perspective of two friends and former chefs. Unchef, food unpacked. Surprised at all, seen them rise and fall. Went up the mountain, it wasn't hard to climb at all. At the top, I found some relief. I finally got some peace. Carry on, but please don't mess up the moon. Yeah, I worked too hard for it. No, I need well, hey, buddy. Happy Sunday to you. How's your weekend going?
Oh, it's going great.
That's good.
That's it.
Done conversation. Great. It's super good. Next topic.
Beans are in the oven, baby. Beans are in the oven.
Oh, is that like a literal thing, or are you inventing euphemisms?
It's literal, but I think it's usable as a figure of speech.
Cool. What kind of beans are you carrying?
Yeah. Black-eyed peas, bruh.
You gonna do the beans and greens, like the what is it?
Hoppin'
John?
No, I typically just start with beans, and I figure out what I do with them.
First stage, it's like that South Park episode with the underpants gnomes. It's like first step beans, second step, third step profit.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I just imposed beans on myself, and then I figure out what I'm going to do with them.
It's a self-imposed beans.
The old bean imposition.
All right, everybody. Anthony Bourdain was a personal hero of ours. The new movie Roadrunner does its best to familiarize the public with the man behind the myth. Today, we want to talk about the movie, immigration, Tony's relationship to tourism, and a potentially dangerous technology that was used to make the movie.
Yeah, baby.
You like it?
Yeah, baby.
All right, cool. I'm going to start with a... apparently, we like the copy for the intro. We're still working
fuck
it out.
Fuck yeah, baby.
Yeah, fuck yeah, that's working for us. All right, Matt, have you seen the movie?
I have not. You're going to spoil everything for me.
I was going to say, I don't want to ruin anything for you. So, I apologize for the spoiler, but he dies in the end. So,
oh, man.
Yeah,
not again.
I know. It's super sad. You've seen the trailer, though, right?
I actually haven't even seen the trailer.
No kidding. Yeah. It's
I wish we could have coordinated on just assigning some homework, but you know, not all of us can just go to the movie theater all willy nilly. That'd be too fucking American of us. So,
that's true. But, yeah. I'm vaccinated. You're vaccinated.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think
bear, that bear pickle, baby. Let's do this.
No, it's a great trailer. I saw it a couple months ago, and it was sort of a date night idea. Ashley wanted to take me out. She knows what a hero like Tony's always been for me. And the movie itself is really good. It's really well done. I thought there's a lot of there's a lot of conversations going around about like some of the ethical decisions behind the making of it, which mm-hmm. I think is always going to happen when you take somebody who's like as culturally influential as Anthony Bourdain and, you know, make like a posthumous documentary about him.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, I think everybody's very, very, what's the word? I mean, obviously they're very opinionated. We already know that, but,
for sure.
Yeah. There's almost a sort of protective factor, right? This like sort of icon / hero. So I could definitely see where people would get sort of up in arms about certain creative choices being made on a documentary about that person. No.
Yeah, for sure. I think Bourdain, in a way that a lot of public figures were not able to accomplish as effectively, sort of made people feel like they had a personal relationship to him. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think that was part of his brand. Like his whole thing was just traveling the world and asking people things about themselves. And he was very good at sort of identifying that there's an underlying humanness no matter mm-hmm. where you go. Yeah. And I think that that's a point that a lot of people have tried to make over the years, and few people have made as effectively as he has. So when you see like such a uniting point being made so efficiently, and nobody else is really making that point as efficiently, I think it's easy to start forming these personal attachments. Yeah. Have you heard about the controversy at all?
I am so in the dark on this. Like I heard about this from somebody else that I was sitting next to in the lunchroom at work the other day. It's like, yeah, you heard about the Anthony Bourdain thing. I'm like, no, I haven't at all. And then I think 2 days later, you're like, I'm going to go see it. And I'm like, cool. And so I'm catching up, but I haven't like really tuned into any of the buzz around it or the trailers. And I'm a really shitty guest right now.
Well, no, that actually makes it good, because you're coming in with like a fresh opinion. You can react with like in the moment thoughts, because the truth is that it's a new technology. We don't know how it's going to disseminate. We don't know how it's going to be utilized. We don't know like what corporations are going to do when they grab hold of it. We don't know what kind of like legislation or jurisdiction is going to be put in as protections against it. Right. But yeah, the technology that we're talking about is deep fake technology.
Right.
And just for the listeners who haven't heard about deep fake or what it is, it's actually a technology that we've kind of loosely played around with on the show with this program that we use for editing, called Descript. And you can basically construct somebody's voice if you have enough clips of them speaking, which wasn't a problem with Anthony Bourdain because he's been, you know, talking to the public for several decades now. So in the show, they actually use deepfake technology to construct his voice saying things that he never said in the real world.
Right. So what's interesting about the editing software that we use is, like, you know, Brandon and I both have our own accounts, right? Well, he can't produce anything that's in my voice. Only I can do that on my account.
That's right.
But there are obviously other avenues where people can sort of generate these voice profiles to imitate impersonations. I know there was a whole thing a couple years back where as a little bit of show and tell, there was a group that was reproducing Barack Obama's voice pretty effectively, by the way. Yeah. It was kind of creepy.
Yeah, for sure.
And so those are the sorts of things we're talking about here.
And you're right to say there are workarounds.
We should cue a clip of your voice profile just for fun.
We could. Yeah, I could definitely add that in the editing. Yeah. In fact, I'm going to like segue like we do it. So here's me saying, what's a goofy sentence I could say that could be like reconstructed?
I don't know. I think you're going to think of it, though.
We're going to think of a goofy sentence. All right.
You don't think of it right now, but
I'm trying to think of something that's like funny, but not like too funny, you know? Like, I don't want to be too funny. Like, I feel like the audience is already falling in love with me, and I gotta slip that rule. I'm a taken man, audience. I can't have you falling too much in love with me and my stupid sentence structuring abilities. I'm such a stupid person. Anyway, okay, so here's me saying, I like to eat poops and farts in my human voice. And here is me saying,
I like to eat poops and farts
in a robot voice. You see what I did there? It's going to like go back in. We're going to edit it in. I like to eat poops and farts in a robot voice. All right, so
he's being totally genuine right now, too.
Yeah, this is all happening in real time. I haven't done any of this stuff, but we're going to come back and we're going to do it. And it's going to be awesome. And you're going to be like, okay, you're probably going to tell if it's a robot voice. There's not as much information to use on my voice as there was for Bourdain. You have my password to Descript. Like, if you wanted to go in there and like fuck around with my voice, like, you could. And
don't, you know, threaten me with a good time. That's the next move, is Matt fucking with Brendan's voice. You've struck gold. Stop digging.
Like, do you want Brendan to say anything else? You're like, nah, I'm good. I'm covered. But so just to get back into like this being used to emulate Bourdain's voice, I feel like you know, just from what I knew about Tony, which obviously isn't a lot, like I never met him. I'm going to refer to him as Tony throughout the show because that appears to be what his friends called him. I wish I could have met him. I wish I could have drank a beer with him. I wish I could have traveled to Vietnam with him. Didn't get the chance to, but, you know, I do think that just watching his show for as long as I did and being as impacted by what I knew about the man, I find it hard to believe that he would be interested in being kind of the person at the front of the conversation on deepfake technology. Just my impression. I'm going to try not to ruin too much of it. I don't think that there's a lot to really ruin about the movie. Again, like you already know, he dies in the end. I think that it's a story about somebody who is like an intensely public figure for so long. So there's not a lot to be said. It's really just what it was like to be close to the person, taking some of the myth out of the man. I like the movie. I thought a lot of it was really well done. I think it is basically impossible to be wholly genuine on the big screen. You know, you need to be okay with that going in. Movies are basically required to manipulate you emotionally in order to be successful. That's what they set out to do. They set out to take you like out of the real world and transplant you into something a little bit better. Right. So there's an inherent dishonesty, but it's one that we purchase into. I think that there is a good slippery slope argument about using anyone's voice to say things that they didn't say. You are by design synthesizing a manipulation. And in this case, it is done without explicit permission by the person whose voice was used. Like Anthony was, like Tony was already dead by the time this movie was, you know, set out to be made. So, and you can't get around that fact. The director refuses to reveal which scenes utilize the deepfake voice, but there is at least one you can identify using logic, even if it is difficult to like differentiate tonally, whether like it sounded like him. Like you can kind of tell just like off of using your reasoning, your superior powers of reasoning. But it does sound like him. So Tony's voice is used to read an email that he wrote, but he never said it out loud. It was, you know, kind of talking about like his mental health struggles. It was very personal, dealt with his mental health. The director makes the argument that he didn't use Tony's voice to say anything that he didn't personally write. And he didn't even do that without the permission of his ex-wife and brother. So like he had close, you know, members of Tony's family giving him permission, which I think is a fair point. And he strengthens this point by saying that what he's doing is kind of shining a light on mental health issues. You know, I think I agree with the director's argument here, but that's with a big asterisk attached. We should absolutely be keeping an eye on this technology in the era of identity politics, I feel.
Right.
Yeah, that's my stance on just the usage of this technology. How do you feel about it?
Fucking, what the fuck is that? God, sorry, I'm so sorry. I got like dogs whimpering. I got cats fucking digging.
I was wondering if that was on your end or mine. I was like, is Wally outside? God. Like whining?
Where's Delta? Okay, can you bring her in? Because she's just like whining out there. It's driving me nuts.
I'm gonna check to see if that's Wally. I think Wally's whining at my door too.
Oh, that might be Wally. We don't know. We don't know which side of that we're coming from here.
I feel like from the outside in, making a podcast seems like an easy thing to do. But like when you're actually doing it, you're like, what's going on? Why is this a thing? Why are people doing this right now?
Right.
My dog has joined us in my lap. I'm hoping that's
was that him?
Yeah, I don't think that it was Delta.
Oh, sorry, Wally. No offense, pal.
I think it was my dog. So he's here.
Hey, buddy. Hi there. You having a rough morning, afternoon, whatever?
Oh, I get it. Rough, because that's what a dog says.
Rough. I get it.
All right, so let's get this back on track. Did you ever hear of Tony's plans for Pier 57 in New York City?
I have not. No. What's the deal there?
Yeah, so that's I'm not sure how much that like spread outside of New York City. I think the only reason that I really knew about it was because I was, you know, on the food scene in New York City while it was being talked about. But essentially, Tony wanted to take this huge area, Pier 57, and turn it into kind of like an outdoors hawker market. Hawker is like, you know, a street food terminology. And the thing that was really interesting was he was doing this throughout 2016 to 2018. You'd get a lot of information here and there about like this awesome thing that was being, that was in the works from this person who's basically a culinary god. Like, it had been a while since Bourdain was a chef, and admittedly he wasn't the best chef, but he was still a culinary icon just because of the way that he thinked or thought and then thinked the way that he thinked the way he tended to bring like professionals together, and the way that he made like it seem like this human thing that we were doing, that we were engaged in as food professionals, and not just like, it's one of the hardest part about being a food professional sometimes is you're just viewed as this blue collar laborer, no matter how much thought goes into your job, no matter what it is that you do. There's a level of unappreciation, people thinking that they're paying too much, they're scrutinizing what it is that you're doing, that you basically exist to serve them. So he was somebody that gave a lot of validity, I think, to a lot of people. So, you know, we were all excited. The food world was excited to see like this thing that he was going to try and create. And
obviously, it never happened.
Yeah, it never happened. And I think the reason that he listed it as being such a problem was he wanted to do it like legitimately. He wanted to get immigrants to come in and, you know, actually cook their own food. Like, he wanted to have, like, you know, the world represented on Pier 57. He wanted it to be somewhat of a microcosm. And the way that he knew how to do that was through food. But, like, the big struggle, it wasn't getting the money, because he was rich and people were willing to invest in him. You know, he wasn't like, he wasn't like Bill Gates rich, but he had the money to like put some coin down if he wanted to, and he had the name that like investors would have bought into. But like the big issue was like getting visas for all the people. This is the one that like he said was like the big hang up for making it happen, was this attempt to get visas for all the workers that would need to come in to make the market operate the way that, you know, he thought that it should.
Right. Right.
Is that on your end or my end?
I don't know.
Who's vacuuming?
Is it on your side? It's somebody outside. Somebody's doing something outside.
I got nothing over here.
Yeah, it's on our side. Somebody's doing something outside. They started like, literally, I hate this shit. All right, whatever. This just gives me
a lot
of stuff.
Let's go back to some more deep fakes.
I feel like I do want to finish this point about how it was difficult to, you know, get the immigrants to come in. Because, like, I think in his mind, he saw this as an opportunity to sort of create opportunity, you know, for people to, like, sort of seed other communities in the U.S. in a way that, like, I don't know, would have been beneficial to struggling people that are already in New York City. And it might have been, like, inconsiderate to the rest of the country. Like, you're viewing it through a very microcosmic lens to say, like, we're going to have this profound impact on immigration law because of, like, a market that we want to have in New York City.
Right. Just to clarify the issue, because obviously I'm not well studied on this. I've been living under a rock for a while, apparently.
Cooking booch under a rock.
He was sort of set. He was setting up a hawker market, which would probably be a lot of different food outlets. And the intent was to sort of highlight a lot of different cultures and, you know, within the, you know, that represent the greater New York area. And so you've got all these folks who, you know, probably either already have work opportunities where they can work without visas for varying reasons, or maybe don't have work opportunities at all. But he's trying to actually set up like a legit law and letter business, which forces him to have to be able to get visas for these folks to bring them in and employ them.
That's right. That's right.
And that's where it didn't work. No.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was a big logistical problem. And of course, like, you'll recognize those years as being when Trump came into office, which made it an even bigger issue, because that's like kind of a big
part
of
that's what I was thrown off.
Like,
you know, and I've got some experience with this. We had one guy where I work that was from Australia. And if you're an employer and you're sponsoring somebody for a visa, like, historically, that's pretty fucking easy. Like, that's actually like the biggest hurdle. So if you just randomly want to get a visa, it can be somewhat difficult. But the minute you've got somebody who wants to bring you on as an employee. I feel like it gets very easy at that point because you've got employee sponsorship and it's just sort of a immediate pass, right? So that was surprising to me that he's running into all these hurdles, but I guess, you know, this all happening during the Trump administration, it kind of makes sense, right?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was gonna start. Like, this is so Trump's platform, like before he even was elected, you know, he wanted to do the Muslim ban, that he was very vocal about it being a Muslim ban.
I love that him saying that is exactly what fucked him out of getting that, you know?
Well, no, it didn't fuck him out of getting it. He just...
Well, initially, I thought
it did. Was... Initially, it was a problem. Yeah, that's true.
It relayed some sense of intent where it's like, okay, now you're saying it's just this, but you said directly during your campaign, Muslim ban, right? That's intent.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it was. But that ended up becoming the landmark Trump v. Hawaii case that happened. It was actually ruled like a couple of weeks after Tony died, which is, I don't know, I guess it's weird timing, I think. But I think that you've got a good point about, you know, sponsoring other people from different parts of the world to come in and work for you and have a job. And usually the case is that there's sort of a work study thing where you come in and you work for a set period of time and then you leave. And I think that what they were sort of planning on was instituting a period where people came and worked at the market and then kind of using that to create a structure where one person does the study and then they're replaced by somebody else and they sort of take the money that they made and invest it in their community, which is... Right. Again, like, this is a hot button issue because on the one hand, that seems great because we're using our wealth and sharing it on like this baseline worker level. We're actually helping the working class globally instead of just in the U.S. Whereas nowadays, I think that we don't even help the working class nationally within our own country. Not for real. Like, I think we put on airs that we're helping them more than we really do, but you got to be living under a rock to not know that billionaires are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. When you see a problem at home, it's very difficult, especially on the conservative side of the fence, to say yes to a project that's attempting to solve the problem globally when the problem still exists at home. But then you shut down the project globally and then don't address the thing that's happening at home. And that's what happened with Trump. And just to talk a little bit about the Trump v. Hawaii case, I really don't know what this food hall would have done for the economy in the area or even what it would have done for food in the city in general. But to me, it sounds like a great idea, but one that was envisioned before the Trump v. Hawaii Supreme Court case. And that case changed the face of immigration in the U.S. by setting precedent on how we treat our international borders, because that you said that this sort of bit Trump in the ass is wording, and that's correct. It did. But what he did was he changed the wording. It was like, it's not about like banning Muslims. It's about protecting our borders. And
in typical Trump fashion. It's like, no, I didn't mean that. What I mean now is.
Yeah. So he kept all the same countries, all the same predominantly Muslim countries on the ban, and then added like Venezuela and was like, see, it's not just Muslims. He added Venezuela and North Korea. And, you know,
I've never seen somebody be so effective at doing what they're trying to do, good or bad, by word vomiting constantly, just blah 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 blah, you know, like it's fucking insane.
I can't remember who said it. I think it was on the 5-4 podcast, but they were talking about like Trump has never had a thought that wasn't a direct response to something. He's basically like a Sims character that just walks from room to room with like just a thought bubble of a hamburger.
Amygdala and reaction and yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So with Trump v. Hawaii, Bourdain was obviously, Tony was already dead by the time this ruling came out, but it was something that was hotly contested. Trump was talking about the Muslim ban before he was even elected back in 2015. And I think that was probably pretty rough for Tony because even though I don't think that he was really aware of it, he was a liberal icon. He was definitely on the liberal side of the fence, just the way mm-hmm. that liberalism at its core is just all people were created equal. That's it. And that's what right. liberalism is. It's nothing other than that. It gets so caught up in these like arguments about like what policies are more effective. And I'm not going to say all the arguments against like liberal policies are bad because, you know, sometimes it's difficult to know what is best for all people, but at its core, right. that's what it is. And at Tony's core, that's what he was too. I don't know, man. I thought the market sounded awesome. I would have liked a place to go hang out. And I think that, you know, you get the opportunity to be exposed to other cultures and
right.
you like de-otherize people from foreign countries, you know? So.
All right, so thank you for listening. We haven't landed on anyone we want to work with promotionally yet, so we're just going to fill this space and talk about us a little bit. We are excited to see the support that we are already receiving for the show. It means so much to us. If you haven't yet, please like and subscribe on your platform of choice. Also, check out our website, write a review, and sign up for our newsletter. Blog posts, social projects, recipes, merch, it's all in the pipelines, ladies and gentlemen, and we can't wait to share it. So stay tuned, and thanks for listening.
Obviously, Tony dying was a huge tragedy. The way that he died was a huge tragedy. I would have loved to have seen, you know, him as a reporter going out and standing in the breadline and trying to find some way to make those people happy. Because it wasn't just like, he wasn't just reporting on what was going on. He wasn't just like, this is a breadline, it sucks. You all need to know that it sucks. He would have showed up and been like, what are you doing to pass your time? And they've been like, well, we've been playing cards. And because he was there, that card game got a lot more interesting. Mm-hmm. It got a lot more personal, and all of a sudden everybody who was watching was like, you know what, I actually do like playing cards. And then sort of this culture is cemented around it, and that's something that he was very good at doing, was making these difficult situations seem like opportunities to connect. Mm-hmm. That's the exact kind of impetus that I think we were all craving during this lockdown. He also liked to say, be a traveler, not a tourist. And I think that there actually is a bit of pushback on the public opinion of glam tourism, you know, that is a direct consequence of the pandemic. I don't really have anything to back this up, but I don't think Tony liked people showing up and devouring a culture until nothing was left behind, which is something that, you know, Americans can sort of be known for. We show up and we like break 1,000-year-old statues and shoot like lions and bears and gorillas and then put it all on Instagram. And, you know, that's something that, like, it's not all of us, obviously, but I think that we have like this travel culture where we just, you know, go out into the world and we're like, we get to own this because we purchased our ticket, you know,
right.
like the world is a ticket to be purchased. And I think that the pandemic was like, you can't purchase that ticket right now. And a lot of people had to like get okay with this logic of not being able to purchase a ticket.
Right. You know? Right. Yeah. I think that would have been a really sort of intriguing proposition, you know, had he been around. Because I think you saw this sort of focus shift where, you know, you can't go out of state, right? So a lot of people are like just trying to figure out unique ways to blow off steam or vacation within their own like local area, which is whether it's staycation or, oh, I'm going to go rent a house at Sea Ranch, which is like 40 miles from me. Right. And stay there for a week on the coast. And I think that seeing some of his perspective on that would have been pretty valuable.
Yeah. I think I get what you're saying. I think that's a pretty salient point, is not only am I not being a tourist in other countries, like I'm mm-hmm. kind of removed the opportunity to be a tourist in my own community.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Like now that I'm here, now that I can't go anywhere, what is it that I've been doing to make it better?
you know,
like I'm not just like buying a ticket out because I can't be bothered to make where I am good.
Right.
Like that option isn't as available to me as it was.
Yeah. And I think it would have been really interesting to see him just like put under those constraints as well. And like, how do you work with that? Right. What's the message and what's the perspective on being in those circumstances? Cause so much of what he did was very like worldly focused. And then there's this moment where we can't go out into the world, right? We're stuck here. And I think there's a lot of interesting parallels about creative folk, musicians, public figures and entertainment and things, and how they've had to work within the constraints that the pandemic provided that was really positive. Bo Burnham is an example, and what he's just done, you know, that was fucking amazing, right?
And so good. So
never would have happened. There was this really great article that was just basically the whole premise of, we weren't supposed to see him like this, right?
Yeah.
This was not anything that was in the stars for us to go see this person in this way, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's, that would be a very interesting, you know, if I had some ability to see that, that thing that would never happen, like through a crystal ball or some, I don't know, whatever fucking magic mirror or whatever. It'd be pretty
spotlight.
Cool. Yeah.
It's like a spotlight being shined on a dark corner that you can ignore when you're jetting around trying to get the latest fix, mm-hmm. which is like, that was a huge part of his identity as well. Like, it's no secret that he was a heroin junkie for a period. He talks about it a lot. And a lot of mm-hmm. his friends say that his hungriness for more, the tagline for, I think it was No Reservations and I'm mm-hmm. hungry for more, was just like a natural extension of his addictive personality. And I think that when you don't have the opportunity to find these outlets, buying into this philosophy of being able to purchase a ticket away from something mm-hmm. instead of doing the work to reinforce where you are. I'm not afraid to say that he was a personal hero of mine. I think for a long time I refused to acknowledge that because I thought a hero needed to be something a bit more personal, somebody who is talking directly to me. And I think I've grown a bit from that notion. Tony talked to the whole world in a way that few people did, so it's difficult to see him as being like a personal hero because he was everybody's hero to a certain degree. He turned himself into an avatar for liberalism, though, like I was talking about earlier. I don't think he meant to be. He just kind of was, because just to reiterate, being liberal means at its core that you believe that all people should be equal. It's really that simple. I know that's kind of a heavy topic, but you know, that's how I felt.
Man, all this Tony talks make me want to do eat some pot of fool and do some drinking, man.
Seriously. Yeah, so I guess, you know, that's as much as we've got to say about Tony. I thought that it would be good to just take a moment and talk about, like, some of the impacts that he's had. I think that his stance on immigration is something that runs contrary to what we see in this country. I think that the fact that, you know, the deepfake voice was used is an interesting thing that we really should be keeping our eye on. Like, I think that an argument could be made that the director was doing the right thing, mainly because I liked the movie. I didn't think that, you know, if he had Tony's ex-wife and mother of his child and Tony's brother saying that it's okay to use his voice to say something that he did actually write and you can prove that he wrote, that it's less of a problem. But I would hate to see this be like precedent, like the first time that it was used, and now other people are like, the floodgates are open. You know, I don't think Tony would like that at all.
Yeah, and I'd say it used in service to a positive idea as well, right? And I think that's one of the things that there's value to this type of technology. You know, the risk and the problems notwithstanding, especially in this, you know, the day and age that we're in and cancel culture and all those things, like, it can be really dangerous, but I mean, I think this is fine.
Yeah.
I'm good.
And not just
it.
Dangerous for the things that you like, it really, like, it doesn't matter if you go back and prove something false later on. Like, we move so quick from topic to topic. I think that the second somebody's like, oh, they said this, and then you have the sound clip, and then everybody's like, oh, fuck that person, they said this. Like, people are so willing to get on the, like, you know, burn the witch train.
And, oh, for sure.
And they don't really give a shit about going back and, like, questioning those actions for the most part. So this technology is, like, I really hope we keep our eyes on it. Like, I really do. I think that it has the opportunity to be really, really problematic. Again, especially in the age of, like, identity politics and cancel culture, as you pointed out earlier. Which I think is, like, I think cancel culture is, like, a bullshit, like, thing to stake a lot on. I get it that, you know, you got to be more careful about the things that you do in public. And that, you know, a simple mistake has more consequence. But also, mm-hmm. fuck, man. Like, we've been canceling people since, like, again, we were talking about burning witches. Those witches got canceled. Like, they were never actually, I don't think they were actually burned in the US because they were hung. They were killed because of, like, you know, something that they did. That's like, it's the same impulse. It's the same kind of cancel culture. So to treat it like it's this new side of humanity that we're seeing for the first time instead of something that's always been like a social backlash to the way that we construct our society is a little like, I don't know, it's a weird thing to like really, really get into. But again, the second you start like waving the flag, people are really willing to get in line and be like, fuck this shit, but not really all that willing to go back and like scrutinize their decisions or the methods right. through which, you know, they obtained the information that led to those decisions.
Yeah.
So
whatever. That's because we're all losing our minds.
Yeah, we are.
There's a light note.
there's a light note. We're all going crazy together. Like, you might be crazy, but at least you're not the only one who ever said that originally. I don't know. Or maybe it was Lennon. I'm thinking of like John Lennon. I might be a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I'm just turning it into dark. Like, it's, I might be crazy, but I'm not the only one.
I might be itchy, but I'm not the only one.
I am so fucking itchy. I have no idea why. Like, I think I'm just back in my house. And, like, we were gone for several days and, like, I don't know, the dust settled or something. Or maybe it's just Wally's dumbass down here. I don't know. This fucking dude.
No, you just made me think of something. Brandon had this weird, skin irritation thing. She just didn't know what this was, like,
I'm sure she's going to love you talking
Sorry,
about
we're
this.
Totally off topic. We're totally off topic right now. And I think there was a thing, like, a month earlier where a coworker of mine, like, got a scabies infestation and had to deal with all that shit. You know, scabies. Have you ever heard of this?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, it's basically just, like, flesh-eating lice, you know?
Yeah.
On everything. Yeah. So somewhere in she got it in her head that she had scabies. Okay, that's fine. But not only did she think she had scabies, she showed up at my work, which is a very like sort of open,
Matt!
You know, space, like
Matt!
Running in front of everybody screaming, I have scabies. And then my first thing that's out of my mouth was, shut the fuck up and get outside.
She's like, I can't believe you talk to me like that when I have scabies.
She come in here screaming, I have scabies.
That's yeah. gotta be like
the good
one
news
of
is she didn't have
funniest.
Scabies.
That is good news. That is good news. You don't want scabies. You don't want scabies. Yeah. All right, everybody. That's I guess that's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed these thought-provoking topics. I encourage you to get in touch with us on whether this was a good episode or a bad episode, or whether it was life-changing, whether you love me, love Matt, hate me, hate Matt. Doesn't fucking matter. Let us know. We want to talk to you. We would really enjoy having these conversations on a larger scale because our opinions aren't the only ones that matter. And much the way, you know, Bourdain kind of stood for just talking with people, we kind of feel the same way at the show. That's part of the reason he's a personal hero of ours. So that's it for me. I'm Brendan. Have a good night. And you're Matt.
I am Matt. Bye.
You're Matt. Bye.
Thank you for reminding me.
Yeah. Later, everybody.
All right, everyone. That's this week's show. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please like and subscribe to us on your platform of choice. We are currently on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please write us a review and let us know what you thought of the episode. Also, reach out and connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. You can check our website out at unchef.com to see projects we are working on and to sign up for our newsletter. We'll see you next week. Baby, let me fill up whatever you missing. Or you like it up at the top, it's a better view, isn't it? I'm not surprised at all, no way. Hey, what you need, come on, just pay the fee, I supply it all. Went up the mountain and it wasn't hard to climb at all. At the top I found some